Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today.
Welcome. My name is Anne Wilson, and I am delighted to be hosting this special series of Emerge Australia podcasts in preparation for Severe ME Week. In this series, I'll be interviewing those with severe ME and others with lived experience and their carers, as well as eminent clinicians working in the challenging yet exciting field of infection-associated chronic illnesses like ME, long COVID, and associated overlapping conditions. This series is particularly important to Emerge Australia as we launch our Count ME campaign, designed to ensure the ME community is counted in data across the health system and in decisions that affect our community's lives at a time when ongoing funding for Emerge Australia's patient services is not guaranteed. To commence today, I wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of country and their connections to land, sea and community, and pay my respect to elders past and present, noting their continuing contributions, struggles and achievements. As we continue to reflect on the magnificent lyrics of John Lennon's Imagine, never has there been a greater need in my lifetime for the world to celebrate the brotherhood of man globally. A world without stigma, a world without discrimination on any grounds, a world where people have equity of access to treatments and medical care, a world where we have biomarkers and diagnostic tests for those with ME and associated conditions, and dare I dream, a world where we actually have a cure for these diseases. So today I'm delighted to speak and introduce to you Dr. Robert Groisman, MD, from Texas in the United States of America. Dr. Groisman is a pain and long COVID specialist, one of the earliest doctors in the US to treat long COVID, starting before the condition even had a name. Since 2020, he's helped thousands of patients around the world navigate the invisible symptoms, the emotional toll, and the frustration of being dismissed by the medical system. Dr. Groisman didn't plan to specialize in long COVID. He was treating chronic pain and PTSD with interventional procedures when he contracted long COVID himself. His symptoms persisted. Traditional medicine had no answers. He could have cycled through specialists, but instead he did something different. He researched the mechanisms himself. What he discovered changed everything. Long COVID wasn't one problem. It was six biological mechanisms creating different combinations in each patient, like a fingerprint. Dysautonomia, mitochondrial dysfunction, endothelial damage and microclots, gut dysbiosis, MCAS, and exercise histamine, and hormonal imbalance, all interconnected, often missed by standard testing. He applied this framework to his own recovery, and it worked. He documented the complete framework in a 7-book series, The Complete Long COVID Handbook, published in 2024-25. Now, at his clinic in Plano, Texas, he offers what he needed when he was sick, namely answers. He's a diplomat of the American Board of Anesthesiology, of the American Board of Pain Medicine and member of REACT19, member of the Long COVID Alliance, 3 best rated doctors, 6 years in a row from 2019 to 2024. Dr. Robert Groisman, thank you and for giving up your time at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, which is early in the morning in Australia, to talk with us today. So welcome to this podcast series.
It's my pleasure to be here, Anne.
It's wonderful. So we're going to kick off by trying to understand long COVID and ME/CFS. And you've been treating long COVID and have extensive experience, as your bio says, with chronic invisible illnesses. Can you explain the linkages between long COVID and ME/CFS, and can you touch on some of the unique challenges that patients face with these conditions from your perspective, given that, you know, you've been there with your long COVID journey?
Yes, I sure can. And I'm currently in remission. That's what I'm going to call it. I'm not going to call it a cure. I'm going to call it a remission. So one of the main differences between ME/CFS and long COVID is the diagnostic criteria. Long COVID, all it requires is a prior exposure to COVID virus at some point. And the symptoms are not specific to have long COVID. As you know, there's no biomarker available either for ME/CFS or long COVID. So when we look at ME/CFS, the primary concern is the recovery, the loss of the capacity to recover. Most, actually all ME/CFS patients have to have PEM and issues with those kind of crashes. The diagnostic criteria also requires a sleep disorder, so that usually insomnia or something else that keeps the patient awake, and at least 6 months, which pretty much every ME/CFS patient has seen, plus one other symptom such as brain fog. Those are what's necessary to diagnose ME/CFS, but none of those are required to diagnose long COVID. And that difference means that if we group long COVID into just ME/CFS, we may be missing mechanisms that we can actually fix and treat. So the way I look at this is, from the long COVID standpoint, some patients will become ME/CFS phenotype. In other words, they will meet every criteria to be called ME/CFS, but they also have long COVID on top of it. So it's kind of a one umbrella under another. And yes, they share a lot of similar mechanisms and conditions. POTS, for instance, mast cell activation syndrome. And many have gut issues in both conditions, issues with the microbiome.
Yep.
So that's essentially the difference between the two conditions.
So, of course, long COVID patients also run the risk of microclots and other cardiovascular involvement that are not typically seen as part of ME/CFS. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Endothelial dysfunction and microclots or clots are not part of the large core percentage of ME/CFS, but it could still occur.
Yeah. Yeah.
Similar to mast cell activation, it typically, if it's going to occur, we're going to see it in patients who have EDS, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, plus POTS, and they usually have the mast cell on top of that. So in long COVID, though, you don't have to have anything else to still have mast cell activation.
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, the challenge is diagnosis and, you know, the time that it takes to diagnose. So COVID is kind of simple, because if you've had a COVID infection and you start getting this range of symptoms over time, it's highly likely you can get a diagnosis of long COVID. One of the major challenges that people with ME/CFS face, certainly here in Australia, and I suspect in the US and other parts of the world as well, is that a patient will go to their doctor with this whole raft of symptoms, and the doctor may do a whole lot of tests, which usually come back normal. And then the patient doesn't really know what they've got because the doctor isn't sure either. Is that your experience in the United States?
I think this is a global experience. Even though ME/CFS is older than 70 years, it wasn't called that back then, but I mean, it's been known for a long time. It is challenging to diagnose because there's nothing outward to measure. You can't tell somebody has ME/CFS. You can maybe tell that they have POTS based on testing. But as you said, most of the labs and imaging and everything else comes back normal.
Yeah.
But yes, I have seen this here as well.
Yep. And I mean, you won't be able to answer this, I'm sure, but is it the same in the United States that, you know, not many clinicians actually know how to diagnose ME/CFS, that they don't know a lot about it? Because that seems to be the case here in Australia with our, you call them primary care physicians, we call them GPs. So that seems to be the case with our GP population. Do you find that in the United States or is it actually better?
I can't compare the United States to Australia because I don't know, but there are physicians here that do see patients with ME/CFS and do properly diagnose. I just don't know how many.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like in comparison to Australia, we're a drop in the ocean with compared to your large population. So I wasn't expecting, I was just really the general area was, you know, is that something that patients experience in the US as well, that they go to a doctor and the doctor really doesn't know how to diagnose or doesn't know much about the disease?
It's still relatively unknown. And yes, you're right, there is some stigma associated with it, with the name, with the label. And unfortunately, it takes a long time for a patient to really get diagnosed because I feel that if we catch it early and treat it early, there may be a chance to reverse it.
Yeah.
But a lot of times a person would have it already for 10, 15, 20, 30 years before they actually get diagnosed. The most important thing a doctor can do, though, is just listen.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's one of those things that we talk about a lot, you know, listen to what the patient is saying, observe, take a detailed history. That is absolutely what we hear from clinicians over and over again. It's so important, but it's also so validating for patients. You know, if they feel that they've been heard, if they feel that they've been seen and listened to, it makes a huge difference to also how they feel within themselves.
And one thing I see is a patient gets shuttled from one specialist to another. And this doctor says it's you need to see a cardiologist. And this one says you need to see a neurologist. And this one says you have to go see a rheumatologist. And this one says you have to see infectious disease and so on and so on. And patients just get shuttled from one specialist to another, but I don't know if they're actually hearing them, hearing the patient. And look, I know there's patients that could be hypochondriacs, but most are not. And really, you should listen to what's going on in their lives and how it's impacting their bodies and their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. So, because we know that, you know, diseases, you know, tend to silo. And I'm really interested in your research that highlights six interconnected biological mechanisms that create diverse symptom profiles. How does this understanding influence the personalized treatment approach that you provide to your patients, particularly those with severe ME/CFS, given that this podcast will be heard during Severe ME/CFS Week?
Of course. So the first thing is when you have lemons, you make lemonade, okay? And one good thing about COVID and long COVID is it sparked a lot of new research into these mechanisms. So I didn't pull these mechanisms out of the air. These are documented mechanisms that occur both in long COVID and ME/CFS. And the way we can approach this is we treat the mechanisms that are treatable, that still have some room to improve. So if you've had PEM for 30 years, I mean, it's difficult. It doesn't mean that you can't expand your energy envelope, but it won't be a lot. You know, most of the suggestions are pacing, but pacing just keeps you from crashing. It doesn't improve your energy levels or the amount of things you can do. So we try to treat, well, I try to treat the mechanisms that are still amenable to being fixed. Okay. So if that could be POTS, that could be MCAS, mast cell activation, that could be neuroinflammation, which is a big part of ME/CFS. And yes, it's a multi reasons for neuroinflammation to occur and still stay there. And that's what's responsible for the brain fog. But if we chip away at the mechanisms that you can still treat, the person's life will improve. Their quality of life will improve. It may not be back to where they were, you know, before all this started, but it'll be better than where they started from.
So. Yeah. And that is something that I've discussed with a couple of clinicians that I've interviewed recently. You know, if you can make a difference in one aspect of the disease and someone starts feeling a little bit better, that's better than trying to treat the whole lot and get, you know, zero result, which leads me to the profound symptoms that are often dismissed or misunderstood by healthcare providers. So you've just talked about identifying these and treating them specifically can actually be the difference between managing symptoms and addressing the root causes. So,
yes, exactly.
So what can the medical community do to better firstly identify the root cause and then help manage the symptoms? How can clinicians better recognize and validate the difference between the two in this illness?
So that's the reason I wrote the paper in Frontiers, where long COVID is looked at as a network disorder. And the point of this was to show that no mechanism is more important than another, and they all interact, and they're pushed further with amplifiers. There's other mechanisms that act secondarily that amplify the primary ones. So one symptom, let's take a look at brain fog, okay? And brain fog can be caused by gut, okay? For instance, with leaky gut, you will spill toxins and LPS, which is a component of cell walls of gram-negative bacteria that are normally in your gut. They don't cause any problems for you or anything. But when they die off and their cell membranes break, the LPS can find its way into the bloodstream. It doesn't have to cross into the brain. It just needs to be near the blood-brain barrier to activate neuroinflammation inside, because the microglia sense this. And the blood-brain barrier is not just a wall. It's actually alive. It has blood vessels. It has immune cells inside it. And they sense the LPS there and the toxins, and they react to it. So that's one way. So this person has brain fog. It could be the gut. It could be mitochondria. Okay. If you don't have sufficient energy supply in the brain, it's not going to work well. Brain fog, right? Dysautonomia affects blood flow to different regions of the brain. If you don't get enough blood flow to the prefrontal and frontal cortex, you get brain fog. Do you see what I'm getting with this?
Yes.
If you treat brain fog, you don't really know what you're treating. I want to find out what is causing it.
Yeah.
First. And I do that by looking at the entire patient. I'm not only looking at symptoms, I'm looking at triggers. What is making the patient worse? When does it happen? Is it after a meal? Is it after they stand up? Is it at night? All these, plus the timing, plus position, I put together and then determine the primary mechanisms involved. There's usually multiple mechanisms, but one or two are driving and the rest kind of go along for the ride.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We really need to treat the ones that are the drivers first, if we can. So that's essentially my approach. That's the reason I wrote the paper, is to encourage other doctors to look at the mechanisms rather than the phenotypes and the symptoms, which is the way it's classically been done for the last 70 years. Now, yes, there's been papers published with mitochondrial dysfunction and gut dysbiosis on ME/CFS. But what I did was organize this into a framework that you can use to identify and then treat. The second paper, hopefully, will be published on the treatment, which takes the long COVID network model and shows how to actually use it in clinical practice.
That's amazing, and it's really exciting. And I guess just going back to looking at the various symptoms, you know, you do, differential diagnosis would come in there as well in terms of ruling out, like you talked about, people, you know, feeling tired after food. That can also be because they have insulin resistance or, you know, some form of diabetes. So I guess ruling out all the other diseases is really important as well, isn't it?
Yes, it is very important. I know we get fixated on long COVID and ME/CFS. Can't blame everything on them.
Yeah,
people can still have coexisting conditions beforehand, before they ever develop either a long COVID or ME/CFS, number one. And two, some things are just not related. You can coincidentally develop another problem. It could be diabetes. It could be asthma that is unrelated to the main condition. So yes, you need to rule out other mimickers. So things like Lyme disease, for instance, can sometimes mimic. People with EDS usually have dysautonomia. People after concussions or traumatic brain injury can have a significant dysautonomia and other symptoms that look very similar to long COVID. And all these conditions, including hyperthyroidism, hypothyroidism, you know how sluggish you're going to be if your thyroid isn't working well?
Yeah, absolutely. But they need to be, you know, eliminated depending on what the patient's particular symptomatology is. Yeah.
I really focus on sleep. I really focus on brain fog because these really impact people's lives. If you don't sleep, by the way, is another reason for brain fog, right? If you have a couple of nights of insomnia, I don't know anybody who's going to function 100%.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So our former medical director, Dr. Richard Schloeffel, in his clinical education that he does for us, often also talks about, you know, needing to eliminate things like celiac disease and the role of the vagus nerve in the creation of brain fog. What's the role of the vagus nerve from your perspective? Because patients talk to us about that. They mention it online, yeah, etc.
So, I mean, there's two ways that this can happen if we're talking about the vagus nerve. One is the vagus nerve receives input from most organs. And what it looks for is there's extra stretch or a drop in pressure or pain or not enough oxygen coming in. So all those signals go up the vagus nerve to the brainstem. And then your brain decides, is this an alarm, an emergency or not? If it decides it's an emergency, it's going to start the neuroinflammation process. It thinks it needs to protect itself and your body, okay? So it's going to start creating inflammation, not because it's needed, but because it thinks it's fighting something. Not necessarily infection, but a lot of things lead to the same outcome, which is neuroinflammation, where the microglia are activated in the brain and neurons, especially in your brain, do not function well in an inflammatory environment. And you don't need a lot. Just a few microglia are enough to cause dysfunction. And it presents itself like brain fog.
Yeah.
So the brain also, well, the brain stem receives signals from the gut flora. Some of them actually migrate through the nerve up to the brain stem. They don't enter the brain stem, but they still communicate a message. They also send neurotransmitters up that way as well. And of course, there's the other part, which is blood. So neurotransmitters are released in blood and toxins are released in blood. All that affects the vagus nerve function.
Yeah. I'm really interested in neuroinflammation because, I mean, inflammation is something that is a problem for you know, countless diseases, including cancer. Is there anything that patients can do to reduce? They may have ME/CFS, they may have other things. Is there something patients can do themselves to reduce and bring down their inflammatory markers? It may not get rid of whatever they've got, but is there something people can do? Should they be taking some form of anti-inflammatory? Should they be eating, you know, a diet high in green vegetables that reduce inflammation? Is there something basic like that that can also help?
Yes, absolutely. And you're on the right track. What we want to do and what patients can do at home is reduce their oxidative load. High oxidative load promotes inflammation, including in the brain. So the way you do that is just how you mentioned, lots of greens, basically taking in antioxidants. If you can't tolerate greens because your gut or something else, you can take antioxidants as pills, as capsules. They're available over the counter for the most part. And there's a lot to choose from. Okay. There's a lot to choose from. That's one thing. Anti-inflammatories may temporarily help, but the inflammation in the brain is a little different from having a hot, swollen knee or injury outside the brain. As I said, you don't need a lot of microglia to be activated for inflammation to show up or neuroinflammation. And what we're talking about here is not something like meningitis or encephalitis, okay, or even myelitis, which is a spinal cord condition. This is not an infection. And yes, there are autoimmune reasons for neuroinflammation, but what I'm talking about here is something milder, but it still has a significant impact on brain fog. So from a patient standpoint, what they can do, like I said, is take antioxidants or increase their antioxidant intake. And from my standpoint, I try to eliminate the sources that are driving the neuroinflammation. And that may be mast cells, that may be gut, that may be mitochondria, that may be hormonal. There's estrogen and progesterone, testosterone that are involved with the neuroendocrine system. So, and thyroid as well. So any of these can impact neuroinflammation. So I find what's wrong and then attempt to fix it.
That makes a whole lot of sense to me, that's for sure. So people living with severe ME, and, you know, we know that about 25% of people with ME in Australia have severe ME, so they're either bedbound or housebound, obviously have limited mobility and require extensive support. What specific needs do these patients have from your perspective, and how can healthcare systems better accommodate and support them? And what happens in the US?
I think what happens in the US is probably very similar to what happens in Australia. My response is going to be the same, listening to the patient's needs and requirements, trying to improve quality of life by attacking the mechanisms that are still able to change, and trying to support as much of a lifestyle as you can. And I know that clinicians can't really necessarily go into the home and do a lot of stuff for patients. I don't know. Did they do that in Australia?
Listen, Liz, there is an item number for home visits, but telehealth has become increasingly used, especially post-COVID. So, yes. But we have this regulation that says you must have seen a GP for a face-to-face visit once a year to qualify for telehealth. Well, the very severe ME patients can't get to a GP once a year. And therefore, we've got a patient cohort of people with severe ME, some of whom have not seen a doctor for years because can't be seen via telehealth, which is ridiculous, which is something that our organization continues to advocate for. You know, it's just a systemic change that we need to bring in. But it's challenging, and I understand from the clinician's perspective, you know, eyeballing the patient at least once a year makes very good sense. But how do you do that when, you know, not all of our severe patients are supported by people at home or are able to get themselves from point A to point B. Some are, and they can, you know, either go in a wheelchair or be taken. But there are so many of our severe patients that are on their own, and it's just too hard, so they don't go.
Understandable, and I do feel for them. I mean, there's not a whole lot you can do unless you change the laws, you change the regulations. And there's no reason not to allow a televisit from day one and just do televisits for this type of condition. We're not checking blood pressure. We're not measuring heart rate. You know, these people need somebody to talk to and listen to them. So it's just going to have to be a regulation change. And really, even 1% improvement could be a huge impact on somebody who's in a severe bedbound state. And a lot of people assume that they can't get any better just because they've had the condition for many years. But that's not necessarily true. As we said in the beginning, there are many aspects that you could still treat and improve. And even 1% improvement can make a big difference for somebody.
That's a really good point that I'd like to just delve into a little bit further. Let's say you've got someone who's been bedbound for a number of years. What would a 1% improvement look like? Where would that improvement come?
It may mean being able to sit up. It may mean being able to go to the bathroom as opposed to having a commode or urinal brought to your bedside. It means different things for different people.
It's incremental, isn't it? It's small, manageable parts that increase over time, I suppose. Do you agree?
I do agree. And, you know, we're not aiming to run a marathon here. We're aiming to improve quality of life. The basic necessities of daily life, these people have trouble with. You know, being able to brush their hair or brush their teeth or take a shower. Some bedbound people cannot handle that. And when we say bedbound, there's different levels. Some mean that they spend the majority of time in bed, but they're still able to get up and do some stuff small. Other people can't even get out of bed. So it's important to know which grade we're talking about here. And again, we're looking for any improvement here. We're not aiming for the moon here. We're looking to help improve quality of life, even if it's just a little bit.
Yeah, that's really sobering. So regarding research and treatment gaps, what gaps do you see in current research and treatment options for people with severe ME, and what needs to be done? Is it, you know, change in health policy? It is change in health practice by clinicians. How do we address some of those gaps?
Well, first is changing policies and regulations, like you said, to allow televisits, to make it easier for people who aren't able to get out of bed to still talk and work with their clinicians. That's number one. Number two, more physicians need to learn about ME/CFS, long COVID, and other post-viral syndromes. It's a difficult area to be in because, you know, compared to, for instance, high blood pressure or congestive heart failure or traumatic injury, there's a lot more involved in these conditions and care. The other thing, the big gap I see is most of the studies that are done focus on phenotype. They have, you know, collect people who have brain fog, collect people who have gut issues, collect people who have heart issues. But what the missing layer is why do they have these conditions or these symptoms? And if you separate out the biological causes, the people that fit into biological sameness, everyone in this group has brain fog for this reason. Not another reason, but this reason. Then you can do treatment studies focusing on an enriched cohort, right? So normally if you gather up, let's say 100 people with brain fog and you administer a treatment and you don't see a result, you make an assumption that the treatment didn't work. But could it be that the treatment didn't work for the majority, but there was a small sample that it did work for because that's what the mechanism was targeting? So if you isolate the biological causes first and then try the treatment, you'll know for sure or relatively sure if the treatment is helping or not.
Yeah, that makes so much sense what you say.
It's hard to do, though. It's hard. It takes a lot of work and effort to identify biological mechanisms or causes. And yes, it's easier to just collect phenotypes. You know, patients who have pain go into this phenotype. Patients who have cardiac problems, shortness of breath, chest pain go into this category. And patients who have brain fog go into this category. But they're all biologically different. That's what I'm trying to get at, both in long COVID and ME/CFS. And as soon as clinicians really realize that you're not treating one condition, you're treating a syndrome of multiple causes at the same time. And that's what makes it difficult to treat and diagnose. But that's the gap that's missing to get us there. I mean, as I said, there hasn't been a lot of new research in ME/CFS until COVID came along. And people did notice a lot of the similarities, right? And there's many conditions that, I guess, on the surface look alike. But the biggest one that shares most of the pathology is ME/CFS, right? And so things that we learned from long COVID can be applied to ME/CFS. So in many ways, COVID increased research and treatment opportunities for ME/CFS. I mean, if you look over the last 70 years, it's been mainly symptomatic treatment, right? Stimulants to fight fatigue, right? Sleep aids to help with sleep, and certain medications that are used for, let's say, Alzheimer's that help improve memory or improve neurofunction. Of course, you manage the POTS if the person has POTS, and you manage the mast cell if they have mast cells. But for the main part of ME/CFS, there's been very little advancement.
So that
until COVID.
Well, there is no doubt that COVID provided the opportunity for increased awareness about energy limiting conditions like ME/CFS. So it was really a catalyst to help us shine a light on ME/CFS by the fact that COVID just emerged, really. I'm interested, because we're talking about gaps and research, how much money does the US pour into ME/CFS research? Because we're in Australia abysmally behind, for example, Europe, in the amount of support for ME/CFS research. Long COVID, not so, because for the very reason that you said, that, you know, when COVID came along, we thought that some of the things we were doing for COVID would shine a light on ME/CFS. What is that balance financially as far as research spend is concerned in the US?
I'm not exactly sure on how much money is spent on ME/CFS research or even long COVID research. I mean, the original grants were $2 billion for long COVID, but I'm not sure how much spent on ME/CFS research.
Yeah. Well, that's something we're trying to change in Australia as well. We, you know, we've got a much, much, much smaller population. So figures like $2 billion is like, what? But how big the United States is by comparison. So, yeah, we've got a long way to go in terms of equity of spend and focus on ME/CFS.
We all have a long way to go. The entire world has a long way to go in both conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. So you'd work, or you'd be aware of advocacy groups, healthcare professionals, et cetera, affected individuals. What benefits do you see, or what are the best ways of raising awareness and advocating for better healthcare responses and support systems? Does anything stand out for you about, you know, what groups in the US do it really well and what campaigns work and don't?
I mean, there's several groups in the US, several are international. I think it's just awareness and getting the message out to as many people as possible. As you said, there's some stigma still associated with ME/CFS, but the more people that hear about it and know about it, the more it's going to be remembered. And I mean, I think you know, the organizations that currently exist are doing a fairly good job at it. A lot of them are patient-led. Some of them are volunteer-led.
Yeah, that's often a challenge when an organization is volunteer-led, and we have those in Australia as well. Fortunately, at Emerge Australia, we have a very small but highly skilled professional team. And some of our patient services are currently running the risk of not being able to continue past the end of November. So that's why we're running our Count ME campaign. But it's always good to learn from others, you know, and it's always, and we do liaise with groups like Solve, etc. in the US, and we're also part of the World ME Alliance, you know, is doing some great work. So we're not isolated in Australia, even though we're a long way away, but we still have a lot of catch up compared to what we see is happening in other parts of the world. And it would be great to be able to influence our government to spend more money in this area. We're coming to the end of our time, and I guess, I mean, you've achieved an amazing amount in 6 years. I mean, that's just phenomenal. You've written volumes of your book, you're publishing, you're in remission yourself. I guess maybe I should ask you, is there anything you do to keep yourself in remission, or are you a sitting duck? Waiting to
see. No, not a sitting duck. I mean, I do have a maintenance program. It's essentially what I do for my patients as well. So kind of going back to the mechanisms, I had to figure out what long COVID was because nobody knew. So that was the first part, is realizing it's not a one cause, one condition, one disease. It's a syndrome, and it involves many different mechanisms. And then identifying which ones I had and treating those. And I came up with the 6 primaries from the research that was already out there.
Yeah.
So this is completely evidence-based. I call them 6. There's other mechanisms that are involved, but typically these are the 6 you see in pretty much most patients.
Yeah.
And the difference in strength. So each mechanism can affect the body at a different amount, right? And that's what creates all these different combinations for both ME/CFS and long COVID. So yes, I mean, I have a maintenance program that I do for myself, and I do something similar for my patients who have a similar presentation like I did. But you can't treat long COVID as universal. It's not a one treatment for long COVID. It's different treatments for which mechanisms are involved. And that's what I'm trying to get other doctors to understand and listen, and don't just treat the symptoms, go after the mechanisms.
But can I ask you, and can you share with us what that maintenance program looks like for you? I mean, is it a program that, for example, you know, focuses on the gut, or, and you do something for that? Is there...
Sure.
Particular diet that you use, is that
right?
Incremental, any form of exercise? And we won't go into the controversial.
No exercise if you have PEM, okay? That has to be done a specific way.
Yeah,
please. I don't want anyone to think that exercise is good if you're laying in bed, okay? So for me, I had mainly a mitochondrial presentation with PEM.
Yeah.
Okay. So basically kind of an ME/CFS phenotype.
Yep.
And my maintenance program is antioxidants right now. When I have an episode, I also include the mitophagy step. So what I did was I created a way to look at how to rehabilitate your mitochondria. And really what you're looking to do is to replace the damaged ones. That's really it. And that can take 3 months or it could take several years, depending on how much damage has accumulated. So that's also what I use to help with PEM, both in long COVID and ME/CFS. I'm not being cryptic. It's just there's different things I use depending on the person's profile. So I also take everything else into account. Do they have a kidney issues? Are they sensitive to supplement sense and anything in the gut, right? I also take into account the other mechanisms that are also coexisting. You can't do certain things if you have POTS. So can't do certain things if you have endothelial dysfunction. So all this is combined together to form a treatment plan. And yeah, it is individual because each person is individual and each person's experience with ME/CFS and long COVID is going to be unique and individual. It's very hard to find two people that have identical symptoms and identical causes.
Yeah, I totally get that. But when you said you replace the mitochondria, I didn't even know you could do that.
Yeah, you can. It's called mitophagy. It's related to autophagy. People know about that from intermittent fasting and exercise. But this is more specific. We're specifically targeting the mechanisms that recycle mitochondria. And you can't make mitochondria from scratch, which means you have to have at least one working copy to make a clone of.
Right.
So that's what my system, how it works. It gently and slowly replaces the damaged mitochondria.
Right. I'm sorry. And it does that through the various mechanisms or?
It does this through the cleanup process that every cell has.
But what do we do to instigate that? Because if I was a patient listening to this podcast, I'd be going, tell me more right at this point.
Yes, but it has to be done a specific way. That's the thing. I don't want to encourage mitophagy just as a blanket statement. It has to be done a specific way in order to prevent crashes and worsening. You can actually do damage and cause worse condition if you do this incorrectly.
Right.
So, like I said, I've been developing this over the last 6 years, and I've developed a way to do it safely. So it's through different steps, three different stages, two steps, and you don't advance to the next stage until you've proven that you've gotten rid of all of the damage for the first part.
Right.
The goal is to get to stage three in my system, and not everybody can do it, but a lot of people can.
Right.
And that's what expands your energy envelope. Okay. Reduce it. First off, obviously, don't add additional damage by having crashes. But the second is to recycle the mitochondria. And we work on that over time. And like I said, it could take a few months, or if somebody has these conditions for many years, it may take many years to clean it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So a final message of hope from you for our listeners, especially
Sure. Who's
living with ME, severe ME?
So my message of hope is don't give up. Every patient has some capacity to improve. We just need to find it and work on those mechanisms that are able to still be repaired and improved. And there's always some potential for getting better, even if you had the condition for a very long time.
Well, that's very encouraging. Coming from someone with lived experience in particular, and I'm sure that our listeners will have learned a lot from you today and will be looking up some of your work and keen to sort of know more. So, Dr. Robert Grossman, thank you so much for agreeing to talk with us after obviously what would have been a busy day for you in practice and an early morning start for us here in Australia. So thank you very much for joining me today.
It's been my pleasure, Anne.
So today's podcast is part of the Emerge Australia series recorded for Severe ME Week 2026. Our podcasts continue to be a platform where we can together explore the pressing issues faced by 250,000 people with ME/CFS and at least 400,000 more with long COVID and overlapping conditions. As Emerge Australia concludes a federal government funding cycle and we prepare to seek renewed investment, we're proud to launch the Count ME campaign, a powerful movement to highlight the need for continued momentum and growth in support of patient services, dedicated ME research, clinical education and health policy change for Australians living with ME/CFS, long COVID and associated conditions. Through COUNT-ME, we will continue to shine a spotlight on groundbreaking developments surrounding these misunderstood and stigmatised conditions and provide critical insights to equip decision makers, ensure appropriate support to effectively meet the needs of our community. So, thank you very much for joining me again today. I think that this was a really informative podcast. For those listening in, we urge you to tune in again for our next interview. And don't forget, for more information and to subscribe to the Emerge Australia newsletter or find out how you can support our work, visit our website on www.emerge.org.au. Dr. Robert Groisman, thank you so much for your time today, and bye for now.
Bye-bye.
You may say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. And I hope someday you'll join.